as they can.
Keep talking, I'll figure it out.
As they continued their journey, Jesus entered a village where a woman whose name was Martha welcomed him. Saint Martha, pray for us. Is that something unfamiliar to people? You just weren't ready. Okay. Should we try again? Saint Martha. Okay, there we go. On a personal note, my mother's name was Martha, so this is a very special day. So she can continue to intercede for me, which would be very nice, and all of us here. Also, my best friend's name is Martha. So is anyone Babalized this morning? Babalized, yes, is a Swati word, which means hungover. Okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean because you drank too much. It could be because you had not enough sleep or too much sleep or I don't know what. Too much food, too much chocolate. So anyway, if you are, it's okay. We're in it together. And now that I have some coffee, I think it's going to be fine. So where have we been and where are we going? We started on Wednesday evening with our intro, remembering the words from Pope Francis that Jesus is waiting for us, which is very good news. And he is the one who planted the seeds of restlessness in our heart. And this restlessness, of course, is good unless it's unbridled, I suppose. But we have to be restless for the Lord, and we have to continue our search, because we know in the words of Basil Hume that life is a pilgrimage, and that we are on a march, and sooner or later we shall reach our destination, and that destination we call heaven. There we shall see God as he is, and that experience will be the cause of a happiness which will be complete and have no end. And the good news is we're made for that. So we have to keep going resolutely and courageously, even when the road is rough, or we run into obstacles, or we're babalized. We must keep going. Yesterday we talked about two things with Cardinal Hume, the art of communication, and you remember referring that or relating that to the address, and I didn't share very much of it. I just encouraged you or suggested you might want to look at it. The address that Pope Francis made on the 50th anniversary of the World Communication Day, which was in 2014. And just to take a look at that and how the Pope relates the importance of being a good communicator or the way we communicate with our words or our actions and how that relates to mercy. And how Cardinal Hume was such a great example and a role model for how to be a good communicator. That was one of his greatest gifts. But we also talked about holiness, if you remember, and the qualities of a holy person. And one thing I kind of hope you did, because when I've talked about those qualities of holiness before, or before I bring them up, I ask people, what does it mean to be a holy person? And often people will put it outside of themselves as if something is, being a holy person is not something I could be, because I can't be holy, that's only for saints. Well, we know that saints were people too. And so with these qualities of and characteristics of a holy person that Cardinal Hume spoke about, I think it changes our thinking a little bit, that we all strive for holiness. We're called the universal call to holiness, and it's for all of us. And in our daily lives, at different times of the day, we have many aspects of holiness in us, and we have to keep striving for that. We want to strive and notice it in other people and tell them, because that helps people to grow and to affirm other people and the gifts that they have and the way that they exhibit and put forth their holiness and sharing with others. So what I'd like to do today, before we embark on Hume the monk, is share a little bit about Cardinal Hume and who he was also based on facts and also what people said about him, because we didn't really get to say too much about that yesterday. But in Cardinal Hume's tomb, if you've ever been to the cathedral in Westminster, there's something called the Rogito, which is the Latin text of his life. And I was able to include that in the back of my dissertation because it was given to me by Archbishop Arthur Roach. But outside of the tomb is the English translation of that. And so really, it's just kind of like the facts of his life. But just to share a little bit with you, that he was born on March the 2nd, 1923, in Newcastle upon Tyne in England, if you've ever been there. And he was the eldest son of Sir William and Lady Hume. His father was a well-known consultant physician, and his mother was French and a Catholic. And she is the one that transmitted the faith to him and all of his brothers and sisters. And she also insisted that in her presence only, all the children must speak French. So Cardinal Hume was bilingual in French and English, which was quite a bonus because it gave him a bigger worldview maybe than a lot of people would have in England. And if we think about us in the United States, you know, we know English. And to learn something else is somewhat troublesome, and why can't everyone speak American? So anyway, he had that gift early on. And then I was told actually by one of his nephews that his mother, Basil's mother, also insisted that any letters that any of the children or relatives wrote her must be in French. And then she would send them back corrected. So they all know French. He was educated at Ampleforth College in Yorkshire and started there as a boy. And interestingly enough, he was exposed to the poor people. He grew up in a middle-class family, but was exposed to the poor in his hometown because he used to hang around the Dominican friary. And so he was always intrigued by people who had less than him and why they had to live like that and he didn't. So he gained an appreciation and really a love for the poor early on in his life, which had a great effect on him and the way that he was involved in affairs, you know, later as an adult. But he thought he would become a Dominican, but fortunately he went to Ampleforth instead. So he was educated there, and then he was educated at Oxford. And then he went to Fribourg University in Switzerland to get a licentiate in theology. He entered the Benedictine Monastery at Ampleforth in 1941, and he took the religious name of Basil. He was simply professed as a monk in 1942 and took solemn vows in 1945. He was ordained a priest in 1950. After ordination, he held the following appointments in the abbey. In other words, he was busy. He was senior master in modern languages. He was a house master at St. Bede's, professor of dogmatic theology. He was the teacher of all of the English Benedictine congregation, the top scholar for them, which is the congregation in which they're a member. But he also coached the school rugby 15, which is a big deal. Then he was appointed abbot on April 17, 1963, and he led 150 monks whose pastoral work involved not only the school, but also parish work in the north of England and Wales, and he was re-elected for a second term in 1971. On February 76, he was appointed by Pope Paul VI to succeed John Carmel Cardinal Heenan as the ninth Archbishop of Westminster. For now, that's all I'll tell you, except for a few things that have to do with his character related to the qualities of holiness that we spoke about yesterday. One of the qualities of a holy person was, if you remember, having a sense of humor and a zest for life. So Basil Hume did have a sense of humor, and I'm sure some of you remember that. The abbot at the time of his death, which was in 1999, gave a wonderful homily, which I used in this section of my dissertation, to weave in those qualities of holiness that Cardinal Hume himself taught, and then also what other people thought of him. His name is Timothy Wright. He called it a self-deprecating humor, the humor that was so much a part of him. He never took himself too seriously. There was always a twinkle in his eye. And that made him accessible to all of us. Humor's zest for life is revealed in the following story told by Stephen King, who was a friend and former student who taught Hume the art of throwing frisbees, a deeply serious, almost religious activity in the early 70s. As King related, Basil Hume became one of my best students, even getting quite good at it. When I was working in Tanzania, he wrote to me complaining that since I left, his frisbee clientele was getting rather limited, but adding, "I have initiated at least 3 bishops to the noble art and have discovered that the frisbee bounces uncommonly well off the throne floor." Hume's zest for life was also exhibited by his commitment to physical fitness, related by a personal secretary. The first years at Westminster also had their fair share of sporting activity. It was a common occurrence for the track-suited archbishop and secretary to slip away to Battersea Park in mid-afternoon for a jog, or even for a rather vigorous running on the athletics track. As a variation, and sometimes quite late in the evening after a full day, there were visits to a local squash club. An energy-sapping half hour on court was then perfectly complemented by a subsequent swim. The gradual closing down of such pursuits as a hip joint rapidly deteriorated was a costly diminishment. It was also no secret that Basil Hume was also a die-hard fan of Newcastle United football and a great admirer of Newcastle star Jackie Milbourne. But this is key, and this is what one of his confreres said to me. As a confrere rightly said, he had an interest in sport, whatever it was. Perhaps it came across more noticeably because you don't expect it in bishops. It seems to be quite an attraction when religious people are attracted to athletics or keep fit or actually exercise. It seems to be, I don't know, incomprehensible or something. But it does happen. So even Cardinal Hume, so that's another reason I like him, because he was fit and he kept fit as long as he could. He just kept going until he couldn't anymore, and that's my plan too. I'd like to share with you just this little book here, which when I was looking on the internet for all the books about Basil Hume, I found this one, and I said, ooh, that must be a really impressive one. It was like the most expensive one, but I had to buy it. I mean, this thing was expensive, this little book. When it came in the mail, I about fell over. I thought, what is that book? I expected some huge tome, you know? Actually, this Gerard Noël writes books for children about famous people. That's what this book is. And he has a whole list on the back. So I just thought I'd share a little bit that some of you might remember about Cardinal Hume from this book. There are no scarlet robes, nor even a scarlet skull cap, which cardinals often wear on Cardinal Hume. He will just be wearing a plain and, if he will forgive my saying, probably rather crumpled-looking black suit, or, just as likely, an old pair of black trousers and a black or gray jersey. These are his working clothes when at home, and if you are a close friend, he will naturally not bother to dress up. The only sign that he is a priest will be his Roman collar and possibly a plain cross around his neck. It is interesting to note that he is the first Archbishop of Westminster not to wear formal clothes on almost every occasion. If you had visited Cardinal Hume's predecessor, Cardinal Heenan, for example, he would certainly have been wearing a black cassock with scarlet buttons and a scarlet sash. But this is key about the type of person that Cardinal Hume was. He doesn't dress casually because he is lazy or because he wants to make an effect. It is simply that Basil Hume is one of the most natural people you could ever wish to meet. He wears the right sort of clothes for the right occasion and would never dream of trying to impress anyone. Knowing this should help you to put you at ease as you sit down on one of the comfortable chairs while the cardinal offers you some tea, coffee, or lemonade. Then as he sits down and stretches out his long legs, you will notice how tall he is. His most prominent features are his slightly sticking out ears, his long nose, and the shock of wiry-looking white hair, a lock of which usually dangles over his forehead. He often jokes about his ears or nose, and they are, of course, a boon to people who draw cartoons and caricatures of him. So there's a little picture of Cardinal Hume. Basil Hume the Monk. A reading from The Rule of St. Benedict, chapter 72, The Good Spirit Which Should Inspire Monastic Life. It is easy to recognize the bitter spirit of wickedness which creates a barrier to God's grace and opens the way to the evil of hell. But equally, there is a good spirit which frees us from evil ways and brings us closer to God and eternal life. It is this latter spirit that all who follow the monastic way of life should strive to cultivate, spurred on by fervent love. By following this path, they try to be the first to show respect to one another, with the greatest patience in tolerating weaknesses of body or character. They should even be ready to outdo each other in mutual obedience, so that no one in the monastery aims at personal advantage, but is rather concerned for the good of others. Thus, the pure love of one another as belonging to one family should be their ideal. As for God, they should fear him with deep reverence. They should love their abbot or abbess with sincere and unassuming affection. They should value nothing whatever above Christ himself, and may he bring us all together to everlasting life. Did everyone get a handout for today? Okay. This is very key to understanding Benedictine spirituality. The first quotation I've included here, which is from one of the conferences that Basil delivered to his monastic community. Strictly speaking, a monk's life is not organized for any particular work or service in the church. His or her main purpose is to seek God, and this she takes on as a lifelong task. In a sense, this is no different from the task of any Christian, or indeed any person. The monastic life is simply one way of leading the Christian life, and this the monk does in community. The principles which guide the monk in his or her search for God and the gospel values which he tries to make his are relevant to both Christians and non-Christians alike. Benedictine spirituality is for everyone. And I'm sure all of you know that Benedict was not a priest, and that he wrote this rule for lay people. The development of ordination in monasteries came at a later time. All of the values of which St. Benedict speaks about in the rule are applicable to everyone. I've shared with a few of you that I've spoken to privately, I have been like a fan of what are called Fred Pryor seminars. Has anyone heard of Fred Pryor seminars? I thought everyone knew about Fred Pryor seminars. Anyway, they're professional training seminars. They're all over the country. And Fred Pryor was the starter of this organization, I think, in 1978. Anyway, you can go for everything. Leadership training, how to be a good supervisor. You can learn all sorts of computer skills. And the most recent one I went to was 2 weeks ago, actually, or last week, in Tacoma, Washington, on from staff, making the transition from staff to supervisor. And some people know about him because the room was packed. And I go for a couple reasons. One is because I like to try to keep up to date on current business lingo, especially starting my new position at St. Martin's, but also to see how much of it applies to the rule of St. Benedict. So I take notes. And almost everything that the man taught, you could get something from the rule of Benedict. And I talked to him at one of the breaks, and I had done that at another seminar. But anything in there is in the rule of St. Benedict and that he taught is for any person who is searching for God. And because of Basil Hume's foundation in Benedictine spirituality from a young boy on, he was able to translate that quite nicely to the people of England and Wales, and not just Roman Catholics, but Muslims and Jewish people, believers, non-believers. And that's the beauty of the rule of St. Benedict and Benedictine spirituality, as well as all spiritualities, but this one in particular, since we happen to be talking about a Benedictine. When I was working on my dissertation, it took me probably, I think I may have mentioned it yesterday, I didn't know what I was doing until maybe a year after I started. And I was in the basement of Mount Angel Abbey Library. I've been inspired there a few times. I had papers everywhere. And all of a sudden it dawned on me after looking through all of his conferences and other things I was just randomly picking up. I recognized that Basil Hume was always talking about the art of this and the art of that. The art of humility, the art of obedience, the art of prayer, the art of communal living, the art of loving. So I said, that's it. Now at that time I thought the entire dissertation would be on different arts. But it turns out that it was just one chapter because my director said, no, and that was the first chapter I wrote of the entire dissertation, which wasn't chapter one. He said, no, you just keep that in the Benedictine space because otherwise you'll dilute it if you try to do it all throughout, even though he did mention it later. But I said, that's what I'm going to do. This is a new way to approach Benedictine spirituality by the art of this and the art of that. Now, I also said yesterday, but everyone's doing the art of this, the art of winemaking, the art of hair restoration, you know, the art of growing old and all sorts of things. But this quotation I put here from Paul's letter to the Ephesians, we are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus for the good works which God has already designated to make up our way of life. And we are God's work of art. And we have a really responsibility to make our life a work of art, which is all about holiness, to craft our lives into something as we search for God. John Paul II talked in a letter to artists in 1999. Not all are called to be artists in the specific sense of the term, yet as Genesis has it, all men and women are entrusted with the task of crafting their own life. In a certain sense, they are to make of it a work of art, a masterpiece. Each one of us is made in the image and likeness of God. And that's a beautiful thought, every single one of us. I ask myself, have I crafted my life? Am I crafting my life into a work of art? And who are the significant people in my life that have helped me and continue to help me? And Archbishop Glasney referred to that yesterday using the word of formation. Who has formed you? We were created in our mother's womb. We've grown. We've been formed in a variety of ways, by the environment, by the people we've come into contact with. But it's good for us, especially I think during a retreat time, it is for me, to think about the significant people in my life who have helped make my life a work of art, and with grace how that continues. And the people that we meet, for example, at the summer conference when you get together, the people you've known for many years, and I was looking at all the pictures yesterday, how people have grown up, have maybe lost a little hair or gotten a little gray hair, And then people pointing out, well, this one was this age when she first started coming, and a little girl I met yesterday was so sweet. Came here with her grandmother. She had her cousin with her, and she says, oh, she brings everyone when we get to be four. You know, it's so nice. But who are the people who have had a significant influence on you in your life and your path to holiness, on your search for God, and those people who have lifted you up on your rough road when you've stumbled, you've run into obstacles, you've been disillusioned, you've been hurt, looked over, shunned? Because we really can't do it alone. We forget, of course, sometimes that Jesus is walking with us, right? Waiting for us with open arms. But I can't do it alone. I used to think I could. But fortunately, I was conked enough, hard enough on the head that I realized that I actually needed to accept people's help. And that was a huge turning point. I shared it with someone yesterday. I was living in the Republic of South Africa in the United States Peace Corps, riding this bicycle all over the place, like a crazy person, refusing to get any help because I was a Peace Corps volunteer and surely I couldn't take a ride with anyone. And this man kept pulling over every day in his truck. Don't you want a ride? I can put your bike in the back of my truck. No, thanks. Until one day, I don't know what it was, I said, no, I think I'll take a ride today. And that started it. And I hope I never forget it, because I said, yeah, sure, go right ahead, put the bike in the back of your truck. I could have done it myself, but no, I let him do it. And from then on, whenever he saw me, he would pick me up and take me to the village or wherever I was going. It's a huge learning curve. And it wasn't just that incident, but just the people who had gotten me there and life changes and grace in order to be awake enough to accept people's help. So who has helped form you in the Christian way of life? But also to think about, are you responsible for guiding others as they craft their lives? And how do you do it? By encouraging, by being sincere, having people who look to you for guidance. How do you do it? How do you get help to learn how to do it for other people? So not all of us are called to be artists in the specific sense of the term, but all of us are entrusted, really, with the gift of crafting our lives. And how do we do that? How do we make our life a work of art? By various arts. So with Basil Hume, as I mentioned, he was always talking about the art of this and the art of that. And first and foremost, he talked about the art of monastic instinct. And because the monastic way of life, according to the rule of St. Benedict, is for everyone, we can transfer that quite nicely to what I said, well, what about Christian instinct? And what does that mean, to have an instinct for the life, to have an instinct to know how to behave, or the proper way, although I might not always do it? But how does Basil Hume talk about monastic instinct, and how can we translate that to our lives? It's a kind of instinct by which one is able to judge what is fitting and what is not. It's an instinct where you're able to judge what is fitting and what is not. And this can cover a wide spectrum of activity, attitude, speech, the way we pass our holidays, how we spend money, the kind of hospitality we give, the kind we receive, our behavior, things that we say, and our values. There's no end to it. This is a pretty good way to spend your holiday. How often do I think about it? It's really everything. When I'm in the monastery, it can't be one way of life, and when I'm out, another way. It's the authenticity, I think, that we saw in those that met Cardinal Hume, what I learned about him, of being an authentic person. Of course, being human, making mistakes. How I handle disappointments, how I handle it when I'm grumpy, a little bobble-eyed, frustrated, impatient, because things aren't going the way that I think they should go. So what about Christian instinct? A priest, it's been about a month ago now, was giving a homily. It was in a mass with some Cistercians in California, a Jesuit. And he was talking about the martyr of the day, and I can't remember which one. He said, but if we were in a situation where Christians were martyred, would there be enough evidence to convict us? And I said, whoa, I don't know. So what is fitting for a Christian and what is not? How will people know us by our activities, our attitudes, our speech, how we communicate with one another, how we spend our vacations, how we spend our money, the kind of hospitality we give and receive, and our behaviors and values, how I accept someone's help or offer to help. Do I say, no, I'll just do that myself? Do I acknowledge the gift of that the person is giving me by providing hospitality or helping me in some way? And if we look to the rule of Saint Benedict, two of my favorite verses in the entire rule, chapter 4, the tools for good works, verse 20, our way of acting should be different from the world's way. So, is it? Would there be enough evidence to convict us, to have us become martyrs, if that were the situation right now in the room? So the art of having an instinct for a particular way, what are our priorities in life? And Archbishop Glasney said it yesterday, okay, these classes are all fine and good, but without prayer, it doesn't mean anything. We've got to have the solid foundation of daily prayer, fitting it into our busy schedules as best as we can. So the art of Christian instinct or monastic instinct. The art of being Benedictine. One of the monks at Ampleforth, he's living, he's a wonderful man named Cyprian Smith, and he used to be the novice director, and he has a little book out that is like a compilation of some of the conferences that he gave to his novices. And it's a really nice book, I would recommend it, but you have all the footnoted references there. It's called The Path to Life, Benedictine Spirituality for Lay People. But have you ever thought about the difference between being and doing? And I was talking with some people about this yesterday. I think it's very key to the society today and what we actually focus on. Do we focus on being or do we focus on doing? And he said, our life as Christians is not about doing anything, but about being something. Our life is not about doing anything, but it's about being something. Once we understand and start to become what we are meant to be, then we have a much better chance of understanding and achieving what we are meant to do. What then becomes an instinct for us, that we just know what to do? Because we are in the process of becoming what we are meant to be. It's a lifelong journey. That's the search. It's about becoming, falling down, stepping back, moving forward, going to the side, people picking us up. So what is the difference between doing and being? We live in a functional society. What do you do? What do you do? Do you have a business card? What's your job title? It's also easy. It doesn't put us really in a vulnerable position just to talk about what we do, not about who we really are. But how can we transform or maybe change how we relate to other people or communicate, trying to have a remembering that each one of us is made in the image and likeness of God. There's a person sitting there. Yesterday, when I read the introduction to the book that had an impact on me from Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi, but the editor said Cardinal Hume was always saying, remember, it's people first, not the principles. We've got people, human beings. And sometimes we're in a rush and we have to just say, do this, do that, do this. But how can we remember that there's a person on the other end of the email? There's a person on the other end of the phone. There actually is a person on the other end of the text, believe it or not. Especially today, especially in religious communities, and not just religious communities, parishes, which is a religious community, but as things get smaller and people look at that as diminishment, it's about how do we keep things going. But I love this quotation. We do not take you into this community because we think you're going to be useful to us. We do not take you on because we want your skill or your experience. We have taken you on because we think you are seeking God, and we think that you will make good monks. That is what matters. Welcome to the parish. How can we help form this person on his or her search for God, sharing the Christian values, sharing the instinct that we have for God by the way we act? So do you think society places a greater value on doing or being? Something to reflect on, maybe, and how you've experienced it in your own life. And I've talked to a lot of people individually here, but with my new job I'm taking on Monday, it's quite a shift from what I have been doing. And being in an environment, well, of course, function is a huge priority, and what a person has done and what why a person was hired for a particular job obviously has to do with something you've done. But how I have to stay grounded in the spirituality that's been a gift, and grounded in my faith, surrounded by, sure, other people of faith too, but everything else. And the challenge that poses to try to stay grounded so that I can be a witness into the way of life. I don't think it's going to be as easy as maybe I might think it is going to be, because it's different. So many changes, a new place to live, a new place to be, and a different environment that's pretty high pressure, although very hospitable also and kind, and also very invigorating. There will be things that I have to navigate. And when I was thinking on this section, I said, what does it mean when someone says, oh, just be yourself? I think, well, was I not myself? Actually, that part of me, sadly, was part of myself when I was kind of drunk. It's like that. Well, actually, that wasn't me yesterday. That was someone that looked like me. That was so curt and short. Or what does it mean if I say, I can't be myself here? I think, well, who can I be then? I mean, there's just one, and I have to take myself everywhere. But I have to learn to know myself. So what about self-knowledge? Is that important when we search for God? And how do I know myself? Anyone have an idea? How's the best way to keep it trying to learn about myself? Said it. Prayer. Because this wonderful quotation from Catherine of Siena, which I brought my book. Has anyone ever read this? Ooh, she's great. I had a whole semester class on her. She's really into self-knowledge. As the soul comes to know herself, she also knows God better. For she sees how good he has been to her. In the gentle mirror of God, she sees her own dignity in the gentle mirror of God. And my little notes that came from the professor, that's the discovery that one makes in prayer. And what actually do I see when I look in the mirror? All the flaws? Or how about the gentle mirror of God affirming me and loving me and picking me up and loving me even when I'm grumpy? So as the soul comes to know herself, she also knows God better, for she sees how good he has been to her. In the gentle mirror of God, she sees her own dignity. Yesterday we said, do I really believe that Jesus loves me? The art of monastic or Christian instinct, the art of being Benedictine or the art of being Christian. How about the art of treasuring the silence of the desert and thriving in the marketplace? What do you think the desert means? Anybody have an idea? Compared to the marketplace.
Solitude.
Being with yourself. Having time alone to regroup, silence. Withdrawal really from activity to meet God, even though we're meeting God in our activity, like Martha. But we also have to have space. And of course, it depends on our personality too, doesn't it? And how we process and how we, if we're extroverts or introverts or whatever we are on Myers-Briggs and the Enneagram and all those things. It's helpful to know those because it helps us to grow and helps us to understand why perhaps I have a need for this and maybe someone else doesn't. But then the marketplace is when we're involved in pastoral situations of one kind or another, or our work environment. Are we seeing really a blend, a holistic view about our work and our prayer life, our time of silence and solitude? Because I'm the most frantic and the most busy and disorganized if I haven't had the desert time and I haven't made the space. So what do I have to do to make it? Get up earlier or go to bed earlier? Now, of course, I don't have any children running around either. So, but there's other things that you can have running around besides children. But I've watched Tear and I'm like, ooh, boy. I mean, I love children and I like to play with them, but I could not teach a group of boys how to make cars out of wood. As I watched yesterday. It was beautiful, but I'm like, okay. Basil Hume taught his monks, because Ampleforth is somewhat unique, although I think it's all through the English Benedictine congregation, which is monks, of course, in monasteries and abbeys, and also nuns, because all of the nuns in the English Benedictine congregation are cloistered, and the original mission was that the women would stay in the cloister and pray for all the monks who were busy being missionaries everywhere. So most of the monks, I think all of them at Ampleforth are priests. And so he had to teach them that they had to have a grounding before they went out with the people. And he said, we're not going to be safe in the marketplace unless we are at home in the desert. And I said, that's true for everyone. I'm not going to be safe out there. I won't be safe out there. Just come Monday morning at 8. Okay? Unless I'm at home in the desert. And how in a busy work day am I going to be sure, you know, that I've gotten up to... And I think I'm pretty solid, but I don't know, it's just different. I don't know what's going to happen. Different, you know, meetings late when I'd rather be in bed and all the other things that we know happen. But the heart, too, must learn to live in its desert if it is to be capable of involvement in the marketplace. So the heart also must learn to live in the desert. We know Thomas Merton, where was he? In Lexington on the corner of some busy intersection. and it's everything is going around, but you know, his heart and his solitude, that was his desert was still with him. We can take it wherever we go, but we have to actually practice it so that we can take it. I mean, it doesn't just come easily, as we know. I was introduced to long periods of meditation over the past few months, and it was different. Like an hour at a time, and all sorts of things happen. Like I'm thinking, why am I angry? Like, well, okay, this is good. It's a process, and you have to just keep practicing it and keep practicing it until it becomes better, hopefully, with grace. It takes a lot of practice. So it is only in the desert that you can learn to turn loneliness into solitude. And it is only when we have learned solitude and freedom, the capacity to be alone, that we can be safely involved with others. That's packed, actually, all of those things in there. I said it to a few people about Pope Francis. I call him, his many gifts, but one great gift he has is he's free. He has a freedom of his heart because he's so connected to Jesus, I think, that he's free. He's free in his desert, in his time with Jesus, in his prayer time. And so he can be safely involved with anyone. He just freely gives. So it's good to ask, how do we refresh ourselves? So that, how do I refresh myself so I can be my best self for God, for myself, and for others? I often don't look at the whole encompassing thing. No, but I want to be my best self for God. I mean, he's my lover. He's all of our lover, where he's a beloved. Am I in love with Jesus? Well, Basil Hume was asked that question. He said, if I was asked if I was in love with Jesus, I'm not sure what my answer would be, but I'm pretty sure he's in love with me, and I know for certain he's in love with me. And so how do you balance? I mean, I know it's tough to talk to some people. How I mean, you're so busy. You're busy people. So how do we work in? I don't have all the answers. But it's really not any easier for me than anyone else, even though it might think so. Because I can neglect it just like anyone else. So it has to be there, no matter what, however tired I am. I have to get up. Do you make times of silence with your family or the community in which you live? I do know some families that have quiet at breakfast. You know, not too many people want to talk, but it's just like a pervading type of silence. That, not that you can't say anything, but it sure makes a difference. And we can't forget that there is one aspect of Christ's life which needs to be constantly underlined and emphasized. From time to time, he would withdraw from the crowds and his ministry to be alone with the Father. There's all sorts of references in Scripture. He went off alone. Now, he didn't get much time, right? Because everyone followed him everywhere. But that shows us the importance of our being alone with the Father. So silence and solitude were part of his life. He had his desert, and then he went out with the people. And we need to do the same thing. But it's an art to be learned. It really is. It takes a long time, especially if we're not used to it. It's frightening sometimes for people because you don't know what to do. Ooh. And like I said, even in the meditation, I'm sitting there going, why am I angry? Well, let's think about why I'm angry. Because something happened. How am I going to work through it? I'm not going to get up and walk out, which would be a very simple thing to do. Say, well, I think I'll get up and leave the meditation period. I mean, it's a choice one has. But no, I'm really called to try to sit there with it. But then also process it later, hopefully with the help of someone. So to be silent and still is an art to be learned, said Cardinal Hume. It has its own discipline and difficulties. But the learning of it is essential. Lest we be trapped in the purely secular and the material, escaping from the emptiness of the former by indulging in the attractions of the latter. Lest we be trapped in the purely secular and the material, escaping from the emptiness of the former by indulging in the attractions of the latter. And we know Pope Francis is always about that for everybody. He doesn't leave anyone out. How we've just become busy. And this, I love Evangelii Gaudium, The Joy of the Gospel, which I've used many times. He just goes on and you turn the page and think, oh good, he's not talking about me. Whoa! And then he is. So we just get busy. And remember, chapter 4 of the Rule of St. Benedict, verse 20, our way of acting should be different from the world's way. But it's an art to be learned, because we're in the world every day and now in this room. So how is it going to be different? So the art of treasuring the silence of the desert and then thriving in the marketplace. That's a lot of arts. And today I'm not going to talk about the art of prayer, because we'll talk about that a lot tomorrow. But there's one last section I like to cover, because this is a difficult one. And we don't want to talk about it, because, well, who wants to talk about humility and obedience? Well, and what do they mean? Now, obviously, we're not going to answer everything, but it's good to think about it. What does it mean if you say, oh, she's humble? Or he's humble? Or I'm striving for greater humility? Or if you were just more obedient? But they're so intertwined. Chapter 5, verse 1 and 2 of the Rule. The first step of humility is unhesitating obedience, which comes naturally to those who cherish Christ above all else. Treasuring Christ before all else is an art to be learned. It's a constant process. So fortunately, we have a whole lifetime to work on it. However long the lifetime is, we have to just keep striving. So if the purpose of monastic life, just as the Christian life, Basil Hume told his monks, is to love God and love one's neighbor, there will be for a monk no true love of God or any true love of the neighbor unless it is firmly based on humility and obedience. Ooh. So what are they, and do they have anything to do with the pilgrim's search for God? Humility and obedience. So let me just ask, if I say somebody's humble, what does it mean when you think, what kind of being is a person? What does a person do if she's humble?
Usually serves.
Serves, okay.
Other-centered.
Honest.
What about if you did something, let's say, you served the table, and I said, thank you so much for your service, and you said, oh, it's no big deal. Or, actually, it was Susie that did it, even though you did it. I'm not asking you to answer it, but okay, that's just another turn on it. So, is that humility? When I accepted that man's help for the first time, that was a huge growth in humility. It was a very small little thing, But I'm like, you know, I'm so prideful that I actually don't need anyone. I can take care of myself. So I definitely don't need your help. Now, that's not being humble. The way I look at it. It's not. I mean, I don't have to, but the person is offering me, and it's good for me to accept the gift, which I feel is more humble than, you know, just saying no. It's like if someone wants to talk about all of the things you've done, and you're standing there going, please be quiet. Okay? But you know, it's not about me. Which someone rightly told me the other day. A friend of mine who's my consultant, she's a PhD in collaborative learning or something, and she's a COO for a 400-person law firm. She's up on all the stuff, and she's very bright. And we were having a discussion, and she started her job like 3 years ago and came from the other part of the country, and she's very qualified and very accomplished. And she said, you know, I realized early on that it came to me that when people want to tell others about what I've done, it is not about me. Because that's like, oh, it's all about me. And why don't I want people to do it? You know, it's because people, maybe you're proud of her. And they want to share that, look, we've got someone here like this, and she's a wonderful woman, and she's done this, and she's done that. And she said, so it's just a learning. It's not about me. And it's nice to say, look, that my daughter, you know, she can do this, she can do that. My sister can do this and that. Oh. But it's typical. It's an art, really, being humble. That's, you know, one of the many aspects of it. You know, what is false humility? What does it mean to have false humility? Oh, no, it's okay. It's not really me. No, well, that's also maybe not honoring the gifts that I've been given. And that actually I'm supposed to use those for the glory of God, not put them under a bushel basket. And so if someone notices something, then, gosh, I may have never noticed it before. Or when, that's why at the very beginning I said, when you notice the qualities of people who are on the journey and they're like shining, then it's really good to affirm it. Now you don't know how they're going to take it, but you never know. You might have just lit the spark. They might start getting a little restless and think, whoa, I never thought about that before. Shortly after I entered the monastery, the prioress said, can you play the organ? I said, well, I don't know. I've never played the organ before. She says, well, we need someone to play the organ. I'm like, okay. So at the time, I was taking singing lessons. And I said, well, let me ask my teacher. You know, and so Sister Teresa Gould, she's a Franciscan Mount Angel. Perfect teacher for me. So I went in one day and I said, well, can you teach me to play the organ? Well, can you play it? I said, I don't know. I said, I used to take piano lessons when I was a kid, but my mom made me quit because I never practiced because I was busy playing, running around. So she said, well, sit down. And she threw some music on the piano and she said, can you play that? So I sat down and I started to play it. I mean, you know, not really well, but she's like, well, you're not a beginner. She ripped it out. She said, let's go. And I said, okay. So she started teaching me. Now, I'm no, like, professional organist, although it's one of my dreams to be a professional organist and a UPS driver and an opera singer. So I'm still striving for those. But anyway, I play the organ. Okay, now, I'm not like my idol, Loretta Kaiser, who's, like, the best organist ever. But I play the psalms, and I can do the simple hymns, you know, and I feel important when I do it. Because it's fun, no one can see me, so I'm back there going like this. Fortunately, our organ is hidden, the organist is hidden from the people. So I can, like, but I never would, I was like, I don't know. Now, what a funny thing to play the organ. You know, when I tell people, you play the organ? I was like, well, kind of, but I never had thought about it ever. So we don't know by affirming someone the gifts that we see and that. Are we humble enough to say, whoa, I never thought about it? But also humble enough to recognize that actually I shouldn't be doing that. You know, I really shouldn't be an opera singer. But I can sing some. You know, I mean, there's just also that humility to recognize there's someone else that's better for that job than I, so why don't I just let her do it or let him do it? Although, isn't it great when they get down on the ground and they still belt it out? It's just amazing when you go to those operas. How do you do that? Anyway. But I don't have to do everything. And one of the things that came up in the Fred Pryor seminar is, why don't people delegate? What are some of the reasons people don't delegate? Power came up.
If you have to trust somebody else to do it, they might not do it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they might not do it right the way I want them to, right? True. But I said, it might have to, and I raised my hand, I said, it might have something to do with humility. And I kind of said after that, that, you know, if I am not humble enough to recognize that he is actually better at that job than I am, why don't I let him do it and he can shine and grow and I can just do my other thing. And the teacher didn't use the word, he turned it into a pride. He said, well, it could be a prideful thing. But many people contributed and said, yeah, you don't want to give because you don't want someone else to do it in a different way that might be different, and then I don't think it's right. And I want to shine. And some people said, well, if you give your employees the work, then they're going to think you're lazy because you're having them do all the work. So, you know, there's lots of reasons, but that could be part of it. Because I'm not willing to give up. I had the best boss I've ever had, and this was at a huge company in Indianapolis. And she hired, the only people she hired were those that were strong in her weaknesses. She knew where she wasn't real strong, and she worked really hard during the whole interview process with the personality things and the discussions, and she needed someone that was this, and she needed someone that was that, and we worked really well together. It was a great, I think, example of humility, that she was able to say, no, I can't do it, but I would need to surround myself with people who are strong in my weaknesses so that we can be a well-functioning team for the good of the company, for our department and the whole company. It was a beautiful example. So there's lots of aspects of humility, but it's also a good discussion topic to have. You know, what is it? And then, again, what is obedience? Now, Father Pascal Chaline always said, just say yes and think about it later. So I've tried to do that, and I'm like, well, yeah. But actually, that's not such a bad thing if I don't think about it. I mean, unless it, you know, I'm not talking something that's against my moral, you know, judgments or whatever I think is important. But really, it's probably not going to hurt me if I just do it. And then by that time, it's over, and then I really don't have to think about it anyway. So I like that, though. You know, just say yes and think about it later. Now, yeah, I don't know if you can try that on your children or grandchildren or not, but so obedience is just another. What does it mean? And of course, we look to Jesus. Those that are closest will have a better understanding. I mean, who was the most obedient? You know, laying down his life. You know, doing his Father's will, but it was not easy for him either. And what do they have to do, if anything, with the pilgrim search for God, about humility and obedience? And, you know, discerning God's will is not easy. I don't get a postcard, sadly, telling me exactly what to do. So discerning, is this really the right course? So that's where the help of others, I think, is essential. So we have all these arts. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus, for the good works which God has already designated to make up our way of life. And as we run on this way of life in the path of God's commandments and the gospel, we come together to everlasting life. Together, because it's a group effort. Even though I often think I can do it on my own. So each of us have been gifted, and all of those people with whom we live and work have been gifted in many different ways, made in the image and likeness of God. And so how do we craft our lives, and how do we help others, and who has helped us?